When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
It's a serious question.
I appreciate your passion. I share it. I've addressed this question. I've addressed my personal feelings.
And I want you all to know that we are fighting the fake news.
You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and joining me for our regular weekly roundup is John Bennett, from editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, and former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin, and a lot to talk about this week. We're going to talk a little bit about Trump leaking that he may be arrested come Tuesday. We're going to talk a little bit about the Mar-a-Lago subpoenas, his rants and other emails, bringing back Glass-Steagall, the Bidens shoot him up on the road, and bank bailouts and regulations. Oh, it's so much fun, and we can't forget March Madness. So stick around. There's a lot to talk about. We'll be right back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth. With Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. And as we begin today, it is Sunday. Coming up on Tuesday, Donald Trump believes he's going to be indicted and has warned his people to get out and protest. Protesting is one thing, taking back the country, threatening a riot, an additional riot is another. He also kind of hinted around at that on Truth Social Media. But already today, we've heard that there will be a secret witness before the Manhattan DA come Monday. And a lot of speculation about who that is. I can confirm Michael Cohen says he's not it. People that are know Stormy Daniels say she's not it. They've already said it. Ed and Alan Weiselberg, the attorney. And I've heard that we had thought it might be David Pecker, but David Pecker has already apparently testified. Maybe he'll be called back. Who's left and what makes sense? And will Donald Trump be indicted? That's the question of the day. And I guess I'm going to start with Michael. It's problematic. I still don't, and you and I and John have talked about this as recently as last week, about the problematic prosecution of Donald Trump for anything regarding this particular thing. And what we're talking about is this payoff to Stormy Daniels, is setting up a bank account to do it. It was Cohen who indeed paid him off and paid her off, and then just asked to be paid back. They set up a company to do it, and we still don't know exactly what would be illegal about doing all of that. Maybe you can enlighten us a little.
Right. So stepping back, it's close to the election in 2016. Stormy Daniels is alleging that she had a sexual relationship with candidate Trump. Essentially, she says, I won't talk about this if you pay me money. Trump calls that some sort of shakedown, that he was the victim of the shakedown. But regardless, an agreement is struck by which she is going to be paid money to remain silent. Michael Cohen, who is then attorney for Trump, his self-described himself as a fixer. Hayes, Stormy Daniels, $150,000. He takes out a loan, I think a mortgage, home mortgage or something, pays her $150,000, and she remains silent. Cohen then says to the Trump people, fine, now pay me back. And they do pay him back in increments, 10 or 11 increments, which are recorded on the business records of the Trump company as legal fees for Michael Cohen, which they certainly were not. And the question is, does that amount to a crime? Now, first, is it a crime to pay somebody who's threatening to say something bad about you money to hush them up? No, that is not a crime. And we've seen that with other politicians. Is it a crime to incorrectly reflect the reimbursement of that fund on your business records? Yes. In New York, that is a misdemeanor. Normally, you think of business records misrepresentations related to public companies so that they don't mislead the public who may be stockholders in that company. Trump's organization is a private company, so it's a little bit less on point to what business records are intended to protect against. It can become a felony if the payment was made in furtherance of an additional crime. We don't know what that additional crime is. The speculation is that it may involve some sort of federal or state election crime. Remember, Michael Cohen pleaded guilty to and spent time in jail in part because of illegal campaign contributions that he made to the Trump campaign. I think the Stormy Daniels payment being one of those things. So it's possible that this misdemeanor can be turned into a felony because it was a business record misrepresentation in furtherance of the crime of election violations. I think that it's a weak case. I think there are defenses to it, particularly if Alan Weisselberg will testify on behalf of Trump that what he thought he did was legal, and or what he thought he did was undertaken by him and him alone and not at the direction of Trump.
Right.
And so if Weisselberg may take the fall for Trump on this by saying Trump didn't know anything about it, it was all Cohen and me. The surprise witness that is meaningful in this case would be Weisselberg, but Weisselberg has steadfastly refused to testify against Trump. He's testified against the Trump organization in an earlier case, but not against Trump. And he seems to be holding firm that he's not going to do that. He's loyal to Trump, and you know, maybe loyalty is a good thing, but it will certainly be hurtful to a prosecution in this case. So, Brian, it's a long answer to say it's potentially a misdemeanor. It is potentially a felony. I think their case is weak without Weisselberg. I don't think you can predicate a case on Cohen alone, having pleaded guilty essentially to the crimes that are involved in this particular case. And I would be somewhat disappointed if Bragg decided to go forward, especially if his is the first case to go forward criminally against the former president, as I think there are stronger cases. You asked me the question based on a listener's comment, what I think is the strongest case. And I said that I think the Mar-a-Lago obstruction of justice case is a strong case. They need a few more witnesses.
We'll get to that in a minute.
I think that's a strong case. Yeah. And I think that potentially a conspiracy to interfere with the orderly prosecution, transfer of power is a case, but this is the weakest of them, and I'd be surprised and disappointed in the prosecutor if he went forward with this case, and especially if he went forward with this case first, because it'll take the oxygen out of the air for Georgia if they're the ones who's next up on the roster of possible prosecutions.
And John, we've in the press have typically gone nuts with anything that has to do with Donald, and no exclusion this week. This has really gone into the stratosphere, has it not? I lost you there, brother. Nope. I can't hear you, not a word.
Sorry.
There you go.
I was reading Trump's Truth Social, where he is saying that Alvin Bragg, the district attorney that Michael's been discussing, when he came and assumed his office, remember, and Trump is right about this, this case went away. They were focusing instead on Trump allegedly overvaluing his assets over the years. I believe that would, you know, from what I've read and folks like Michael that I've talked to and listened to about this, that seems to be an easier case to prove and possibly get a conviction or convictions. So Trump is going after Bragg, saying that this is politically motivated, and that noting that Bragg himself okayed, you know, focusing on other things and closing this part of the case. So we're going to hear a lot of that. I would suspect that we'll hear a defense from Trump if this does go to trial, that kind of what Michael, I'll build on what Michael was saying. And I think the defense can be summed up this way. I paid the porn star to not say anything because I didn't want my wife to find out. That's not a crime. And those guys chose to hide it on the books, and I didn't know anything about it. And one of them's already been punished for it. So
both of them.
So, Your Honor, how about you just throw this thing out and let's all move on with our lives?
I could see that happening too. His minions have circled the tent and saying, "Hey, if they can come after Donald Trump, they can come after you."
Right.
And to me, that's a very odd way of saying no one is above the law. Yeah, obviously they can come after us, but it's never been so obvious that you could go after a sitting or a former president. And the thing that bothers me most about this is, to Michael's point, if you're not going to bring a strong case, you're only going to strengthen Donald's resolve and the resolve of his base. And I wonder, you know, there's been talk of people with, you know, I've seen on social media, you know, that the MAGA supporters are going to show, they're being encouraged to show up with rifles, and they're encouraging Ron DeSantis to call out the National Guard to keep Donald from being brought in. It's all going to come to a head. I don't know how it comes to a head. And then there is the added, Michael, one last ask for you is, there has been speculation that Donald Trump's lawyer in this particular case is compromised because he at one point in time had been asked by Stormy Daniels to represent her. Does that present a problem should this go to court?
I wouldn't think so. Unless Stormy Daniels revealed to him information that would be relevant at the trial. So, for example, if Stormy Daniels calls a lawyer up and says, "Would you represent me?" and he says or she says no, then there's no conflict. If he says, "Well, I don't know, come into the office and let's talk," and she says, "Well, here's the deal, here are all the facts," and he says, "You know what, I'm not the right guy or gal for you," and then you pick up the attorney on the other side of, you pick up your representation on the other side of the case, that could be a problem, Brian. So we just don't know what information was relayed to the current lawyer.
I want to move on now to the other thing that you talked about, Michael, and that was the Mar-a-Lago subpoenas that have come out this week. They're re-subpoenaing members of the Mar-a-Lago staff. They're bringing them on board. And that's led to a lot of coverage in the media as well. Start out with the media coverage, John. What we've seen on both of these cases, we have been criticized over the last few years for not pressing Donald Trump hard enough. In fact, I was accosted by a guy in California earlier this week when I attended Joe Biden's speech for the victims of Monterey Park for the mass shooting, who said that all this is part of the media's problem because we just don't, we never pushed hard against Donald Trump. Are we covering this correctly? Do we, have we picked up, are we on point, or are we again off kilter? And there you are again. You're,
are we gonna, I know what I'm doing. I've used the laptop before, I promise.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to answer the question. I'm not sure how to give the grade, because we've never had to cover anything like this before. We never had to cover a political figure movement like Trump and the MAGA movement. And we've never, you know, just like there's no guidebook for how to get a former president to a courthouse to be indicted. So the Secret Service, the NYPD, and others are going to have to write that. They're probably doing that right. They are doing that right now, reportedly. And there's also no guidebook on how to cover a former president about to be indicted. So how are we covering it? You know, the folks who are breaking the news, they get an A, I think. There are a lot of anonymous sources, so we don't know exactly where this is coming from. But, you know, at the same time, you know, I don't blame the reporters and the editors who made the decision to publish the NBC story on Friday, because, you know, you've got two or three very reliable sources telling you something. The public does have a right to know. These are public charges, of course, in a, you know, public court. So,
right,
you know, the charging documents are going to be public. How do you not go forward with an anonymous sourced story about a former president for the first time about to face criminal charges? So we'll see. There's going to be a lot of hyperventilating. I will probably join in that in my own coverage with this. But, you know, I don't know if we can be dramatic enough. This is history. This is, like I said, this is a former leader of the free world, and he didn't love that role, but that's what he was.
Yeah, and he never grew into it. But
and if NBC's report is correct, and they've been pretty good on this stuff so far, you're going to see a former president of the United States standing before a judge. You're going to see his mugshot. You're going to see his fingerprints. It's going to be incredible. So we're going to be criticized for how we cover this.
Yeah, I mean,
but
damned if we do, if damned if we don't, right?
Right, exactly. And we just have to take the hits. And, you know, let's be honest, we're running a business here, as Tony Soprano was fond of saying. This is, you know, we're going to do okay this week if the DA's office goes ahead with this and they take Trump to New York and he's indicted and fingerprinted. He could do a remote type thing, but one of the reports I read yesterday, Trump would prefer to address the cameras outside the courtroom, I guess, after everything goes down.
Gee, so I wonder what he'll say.
This is going to be vintage, made for television, Donnie. It's going to be, we're going to be able to close our eyes and feel like we're back in the Oval in a pool spray. And here we go. This is, I've called this, you know, the Trump show. This is act four. Here we go. This is season four. And this one's different.
Yeah.
Okay. Season four is going to be very different. And, you know, I don't know the motivations. Nobody knows the motivations behind them going ahead with a misdemeanor case. But, you know, we've wondered, we've talked here, you know, how could the various entities, and they're all, you know, controlled and appointed and everything, they're all pretty much Democrats, except down in Georgia. We've talked about how could they screw up the chance to politically maybe disqualify Trump, or at least, you know, not allow him to skirt legally on things. This feels like it could be the beginning of all that slipping through the Democrats' hands. This is what they do. They find ways to lose in the fourth quarter.
Yes. Yes. Worse than the Washington Commanders. but that aside, what particularly I find difficult to fathom are those, look, it's a fine line to walk for us. Mm-hmm. We have to report the facts.
Right.
And we know that whatever we report will add to the fuel. It'll be fuel to the fire. How do we make sure that it isn't dynamite on the fire? How do we make sure that what we do is stick strictly to the facts? Now, I know Fox News is not going to. And indeed, they'll throw dynamite, gasoline, a couple of M80s, maybe some kerosene and C4 into the fire.
That's right. Don't forget the kerosene.
So I understand that. But for the rest of us, as you said, this is a place we've never been before. And so as this comes down with the threats of real threats of violence, and we've seen what happened January 6th, I think that we are entering in a very, we should be very cautious, yet very factual and very, very careful in how we report. But
well, can I add one thing, which is
sure.
What's important to remember in this case is that the conduct under investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office was conduct undertaken by private citizen Trump. This predates his term in office. And so just like Bill Clinton having been sued by Paula Jones for conduct that occurred before he entered the presidency, which the Supreme right. Court said is absolutely appropriate, here we have former private citizen, now current private citizen Trump, being held accountable for his acts as a private citizen. And yes. So I think it's important to recognize the distinction between bringing to trial of a former president for private citizen acts he is alleged to have taken versus the acts he took as a president, because many people.
So where does Mar-a-Lago figure in all that, Michael? I mean, he was a private citizen.
That was on the cusp, but just to let me finish the point.
Yeah.
So we have charged Spiro Agnew and convicted Spiro Agnew with criminal conduct before he became vice president. We have charged and convicted other politicians for private conduct before and after they became. And so I think it behooves the press to make sure that they distinguish between what he's on trial or what he's been charged with, his status at the time, versus what would be unprecedented of charging a president of the United States for criminal activity that he undertook while in office. So, for example, if they brought charges against him based on the obstruction of justice findings of the Mueller report, that would be completely unprecedented. This is not as unprecedented. Yes, it's the president. But as I said, we did it with Agnew and we've done it with other politicians. And I think that is.
So now do Mar-a-Lago.
So Mar-a-Lago, the removal of the documents from Mar-a-Lago, the mishandling of the documents occurred while Trump was President Trump. So that's the start of it. Then he's the former president who, when asked for the return of those documents, refuses, and now is under inquiry.
Well, he said at first, he said he didn't, in that June memo said, I've turned over everything and there's nothing left.
No, I get it. But what I'm trying to the point that you're asking is, then he behaves in a way that the prosecutors are inquiring of whether it is obstruction of justice or in obstruction of their investigation. All that conduct is as a private citizen again. And so, again, I think that distinguishing between private citizen and president actions while president is important. And, if Mar-a-Lago turns out that they get the witnesses, they've subpoenaed, as you said, Brian, a minute ago, all of the people who had any knowledge of the presence of and movement of those documents, the key, I think, is the former military guy who's now working for Trump in a private sector role, whose name I can't pronounce or remember, who came to the grand jury first and said, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
Then they showed him surveillance tape of him moving the boxes. They said, oh, you mean those boxes?
Yeah. Right. Hare Krishna.
Right. Then he had his present recollection refreshed, as lawyers would say.
Body. Sorry, yeah. Lieutenant Columbo. I didn't know what you were talking about.
Right. So,
but didn't that always seemed to me like a stronger case? It's pretty simple, cut and dried, it seems.
Everything, Brian, depends on what knowledge you can put in the hands of Trump. So, for example, if Trump takes these documents, intentionally or unintentionally, and brings them to Mar-a-Lago thinking that he has a possessory right to them, that they're his private documents. And the government calls him up and says, no, you're mistaken. We want those documents back. He said, oh my, I didn't realize I was mistaken. And he calls up his subordinates and says, get them what they need. You know, this is, you know, something I don't want to have to deal with. And all of the subordinates go about trying to do that, but they do it in a way that is less than full and appears to have been obstructionist. How do you tie that back to Trump? Remember, Trump, as we have always said, famously doesn't send emails, is, you know, no fingerprints of his left on, you know, the crime scene type of person. And so right. The question is, how do you tie it back to him? And that becomes, you know, the issue in Mar-a-Lago, that becomes the issue in New York, that is the issue in January 6th. What can they prove about what he knew and what he did in with respect to that knowledge? That's always the hard part. And nothing is slam dunk.
Yeah,
none of these
with
cases.
Donald Trump, yes.
Not with Trump.
None of these is an easy case to bring.
But I would think that the letter. All right, so if he had just given everything back, oh, I understand you forgot some of this. Okay, the federal government has always been with former presidents quite elastic in how they apply, you know, this standard. It's like, okay, I understand. You're a busy guy. Send me what you got. When you got something else, send me. But the denial, doesn't that provide, you know, saying, all right, look, on June, we've checked it. We've got nothing else. No, go away. We don't have anything.
Right. And the question is on who is that? And so one of the subpoenas that went out there is to Attorney Corcoran. Corcoran, yes. Refused to testify and asserted his attorney-client privilege rights on behalf of Trump. The court recently said, no, the crime fraud exception to attorney-client privilege, which says there is an attorney-client privilege that cannot be breached unless those communications are in furtherance of a crime, in which case the attorney-client privilege fails because of the greater need to deal with the crime that was under conversation. And they said in this case, the court said in this case, that crime fraud exception applies, which implies that the court believes, based on the presentation of evidence by the DOJ, that the communications between Corcoran and Trump involved a crime. So if they can get Corcoran to be truthful and say what the nature of those conversations were, that may put knowledge in Trump provable in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt. But just like with January 6th, they need Mark Meadows to be able to tie Trump to the information. And so if they get him and he's truthful and he puts knowledge in Trump's provable, you know, mind, then these cases become more easily, nothing is easy, but more easily proven than without these guys. So that's where we are. Everything is, can you prove knowledge of Trump? And as I said, in the Bragg, New York case, I think Weisselberg is required for that. In the January 6th case, I think Meadows is required for that. In Mar-a-Lago, I think that this guy whose name I'm not remembering, who moved the boxes, and Corcoran are required for that. If they get him, these cases are better. If they don't have them,
and in Georgia,
not as easily proved. In Georgia, I don't know. There's no real transparency there. I personally don't think that the phone calls themselves are a very prosecutable, easily prosecuted case to a jury in Georgia, even if it is in Fulton County, because Fulton County is a divided county. You've got Raphael Warnock winning that county in his senatorial election, but you had 30-40% of the people who voted for Trump. And so 30-40% of those people are going to be on the jury. So you got to convince those people, because you have to have a unanimous jury, that these phone calls were not legitimate phone calls made by Trump, who sincerely believed that this election was fraudulent in Georgia, and that all he was trying to do
was... there aren't enough strikes in the prosecutor's fold there to enable him to stack the jury with people who do not believe Donald Trump. You're correct.
Correct.
That's, voir dire won't help.
So again, the question is, what do they have beyond the phone calls? Because again, I think those phone calls, when you cherry pick, so the worst of them, worst of the parts of them, are not helpful to Trump. But I don't think in their full context, they make a case that you can convict on. I'm filibustering.
That's all right, John. You got the next word there.
And John is finally off mute, so let's. Yeah.
John, you're not on mute, are you?
Maybe the listeners would prefer if I was on mute.
No, hell no.
Let me just throw out an idea here about this last witness, mystery witness in New York. Could it be someone from the 2016 Trump campaign? And then if they were involved in conversations about, we got to pay this lady off, we got to keep her quiet, we got to get this thing over to the Inquirer, they'll capture, they'll kill it, and let's get to get across the finish line of the election. If that kind of coordination was there, then they might be able to bump this thing up to a felony. That might be more easily, well, maybe not easily provable, but more easily argued if they have that connection straight into the campaign.
And who might that be, John?
Well, there's a gentleman named Paul Manafort. You might remember him. David Bossie took over. He took over the campaign. Steve Bannon was around.
He's not going to testify.
Right. So, but there are folks. There are folks in the campaign who may be looking at this and saying, "Well, you know, I'm not going to have this on my record, even if it's just a misdemeanor. You know, if the prosecutors are leaning on them somehow." Maybe they've decided it's in their best interest to testify against the boss.
And with that wonderful thought, we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, well, let's talk of presidential politics from the past. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you and we need your help. Seriously. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we're back. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam, and with me again from CQ Roll Call is Editor-at-Large John Bennett and former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin. And Michael, you helped, as we were talking about before the case, you investigated a long time ago another one of my favorite criminals that became president, Ronald Reagan, and in his attempt to the run-up. The rumor always was, and it was reported widely after the fact, that Ronald Reagan had reached out some way to Iran and convinced them to wait and turn over the hostages after he became president. And now this week, it seems like there is some information that would actually confirm that. You want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Jimmy Carter is president. The American hostages are taken by the Ayatollah Khomeini after he takes over as the supreme leader from the civilian government headed by Bani Saad. Carter goes into a Rose Garden lockdown. I'm not going to do anything until I get those hostages out. The Reagan campaign, in its internal polling, determines that the only way Carter's going to beat them is to get these hostages out. If he can get them out in October, a so-called October surprise, then Carter, because of the goodwill of getting them out, will be able to potentially beat Reagan. Without that, the Reagan people are convinced Reagan is going to win. So the theory—
And a reminder there, for those who don't remember, they staged an attempt to free the hostages and couldn't find five helicopters in the U.S. military that could work. And in fact, there was a helicopter went down in the desert. It led to a lot of it led to a large surge of spending on the Department of Defense afterwards, but it also led to Ronald Reagan becoming president. Go ahead from there.
All right. So the hostages are in Iran. You're right to say that Carter, they were all in one place. And Carter undertakes this secret mission. He's going to fly these helicopters in at low altitude. They hit a sandstorm, unfortunately, and they're unable to achieve their mission's goals. Afterwards, the hostages are displaced around different locations, and getting them out would be an impossibility. Reagan, though, is still concerned about the possibility of an October surprise. And the theory is, and it's promoted by an NSC analyst, a reputable guy named Gary Sick, who wrote a book saying, some years later, saying, I saw cable traffic that reflects that Bill Casey, head of the Reagan campaign, was in fact in touch with the Iranians about not releasing these hostages until Reagan won. And in fact, what, you know, sort of, is a point of reference is that the hostages were released like 20 minutes after Reagan is sworn right. in as president. In fact, I think the first words out of Reagan's mouth when he comes out of the presidential luncheon is that the hostages have been released, getting all the goodwill that Carter worked so hard to try to achieve. And in fact, the hostages were released as a result of the State Department negotiations with Tehran for months on end. Now, so Congress decides they're going to investigate whether it's true that there was this secret deal to release the American hostages, and they form a committee, and I'm the deputy majority counsel on that committee. And we spend a year looking into the question of whether or not we can prove that, in fact, Bill Casey and the Reagan campaign were in conversations with the Iranians about withholding the release of the American hostages. Our report concluded that we couldn't find evidence of it. I don't think we said affirmatively it didn't happen. We said we can't find evidence of it. I think that's my recollection. We may have said we it didn't happen, but I think we said we couldn't find evidence of it. Now, you know, 40 years later, this Texas politician, businessman, has come forward with Carter in hospice as the reason for why he's breaking his silence now, like Deep Throat is about to die. So he decided he's going to say, I'm Deep Throat. This guy comes forward and says, look, I was traveling around with John Connally, governor of Texas. John Connally shot in the motorcade with John F. Kennedy. Right. And I can tell you that everywhere we went on this Middle Eastern trip, Connally and I, Connally was saying, get a message to Iran that if they don't release the hostages, Reagan will treat you better than you've been treated in the past under Carter. And he says that message was sent to all the Middle Eastern countries, and that those countries were instructed to let Tehran know of it, and that when they got back, Casey was informed of the success of that effort. So 40 years plus since this occurs, this guy out of the blue comes out and says, oh, by the way, I knew all about this. And Peter Baker,
where has he been for 40 years?
Well, Peter Baker, the terrific reporter for the New York Times, reports what this guy said. And he's a serious guy. This person is making these allegations. So it's not like he's, you know, some fly by night. And so you have to take it seriously. You know, so I, since the article was, since I was interviewed by Peter, and since the article has come out, I've spoken to most of the people on our team, and we've all said, where was this guy when this very public investigation was ongoing? And should that give us pause as to the accuracy of what he's saying? That said,
well, John,
of course,
should we be asking Michael, why didn't he subpoena him 40 years ago?
We didn't know of his existence. We had subpoena power. If we knew of him or Connolly, we absolutely would have subpoenaed them. But the thing that was most telling in the Peter Baker article was long after our investigation, Robert Parry, a journalist, a good journalist, finds a memo that says, oh, by the way, Bill Casey was in Madrid, which is one of the key allegations that we had to investigate. Was he in Madrid and were there secret meetings? We asked the State Department, we asked the NSA, we asked the intelligence community, is there any record of this? And they said no. 20 years later, they pull up this cable and says, oh, by the way, Bill Casey was in Madrid. So maybe this thing did occur, and the forces of government in 1991 or two, when we were investigating this, hid this from us. And maybe John Connolly, who was still alive at the time, I believe, hid this from us. And maybe this guy hid this from us. And so our investigation was spoiled by the acts of badly motivated people who now, you know, because Jimmy Carter is in hospice and they want to make him, you know, happy on his deathbed, that, oh, by the way, you lost because your campaign was sabotaged. You know, it's a pretty cruel thing to do. I don't see how
there's a nice way to send somebody off into the afterlife.
Yeah, you know, like if you lie on your deathbed and says, oh, by the way,
you lost the
presidency because of, you know, potential criminal activity by the Reagan campaign or its surrogates, I'm not gonna say, oh, great, I can go to my maker now with a smile on my face. So I don't quite get the motive there, but that's the bottom line of it. This guy has come forward to say that that the October surprise was true. We didn't, as I said, we didn't find evidence of it. But
well, John, wait a minute. Let me rope John in here for this.
You know, because it just raises the question of whether we were lied to by the government, as you said, now, Brian. I'm shocked. Yeah. Right?
John, aren't you shocked that the government would lie to us?
Oh yeah, just shocked. Just I can't believe it. That never happens.
Gambling in Rick's place.
Yes.
You know, I just listening to Michael tell the story is fascinating. But you know, I'm thinking about Carter's career, his political career, especially, well, not so much as governor, but once he became president. I wrote, this is one of the darker things. I'll pull the curtain back for a second. It's one of the grimmer things that we have to do in this business. I, years ago, prepared CQ Roll Call's Jimmy Carter obituary. And my colleagues and I have been the last few weeks, you know, updating it as needed and
right.
gave it what we call a write through and added some new substance to it when he entered hospice care. And I can tell you that that's vintage Carter. The guy couldn't catch a break. And even when a break might have been in front of him as president, he just tripped right over it. And he and his team weren't really prepared for the presidency. And just
I remember cardigan sweaters. That's what I remember.
Yeah. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, they didn't know about this, or that there were, you know, folks on the NSC or elsewhere in the government who might have been involved in you know, helping him not win re-election. That doesn't surprise me at all, having gone back through his term as president and updating the obituary. It's just brutal. It's the resume, if you want to look at his presidential resume, it's just brutal. And this is just another, yeah, like it's just kicking a guy while he's literally down. I mean, he's on his deathbed, and it's just incredible. But it's almost a fitting punctuation on his presidency.
What I find, what I find about it is that particular crime, and I can't describe another word for it. I can't figure another word for it. That crime against the American people helped set the table for the crap that we've had to endure for the last 40 years, which includes Donald Trump. In that one action, that one criminal action set into motion events that have led to what we have now today in our government. Mm-hmm. And for that, there is a depth in hell deep enough to plunge those people into, especially those who kept silent all these years about that crime. Ronald Reagan set the table for everything that came afterwards. He helped destroy his supply side economics has destroyed savings, organized labor, healthcare. What he did with the press has helped to lead to the consolidation of the media into six large companies. There isn't one bad thing in the U.S. that hasn't occurred in the last 40 years because of Ronald Reagan, and that action helped do it. And so I think that guy should be condemned to the deepest depths of hell. Now, with that said, we're going to move on.
Can I just add one thing
to John? You want the last word again. Okay, go for it.
No, I'm just hoping, John, that your obituary of Jimmy Carter says greatest ex-president in modern history. Because what he did upon leaving the presidency compared to everybody else is an example of what a public servant acting in the public interest should do, rather than make speeches.
He's been compared to Cincinnatus.
Well, you know, most ex-presidents become very, very wealthy, making speeches to all sorts of organizations, domestic and
foreign.
And Carter did not do that. I mean, George W. Bush is you know, an example of a person who's doing well as an ex-president, not completely capitalizing on it. He's done some. But Carter, with his Habitat for Humanity and all of his faith-based public service initiatives, deserves a special mention.
He was a true Christian, too. I mean, for those who claim to be Christian, he was a guy that would not join the John Birch Society. He was the one that wouldn't join the society against black farmers. He was called a, quote, in-lover. Because he would not do what the Southern and he was threatened with we're not going to buy your peanuts if you back black people. And he said he didn't care. And he famously said that his faith told him to do whatever he could for everyone that he could for as long as he could with whatever he could. And
he was a lover of good rock and roll music.
Oh, yes. And a fan of Willie Nelson's, and put solar paneling on the White House, and Reagan took it down. So with that being said, let's move on to bank bailouts and regulations.
More fun, uplifting talk.
More fun, uplifting talk. Think about that, and we'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Here we are. It's Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Kerriman. It's a super silly Sunday with all the fun and frivolity that March Madness provides, including the number one team being knocked off and Kansas going, well, we'll get to that in a minute, and your letters. But right now, quickly, let's go through the bank bailouts and the regulation problems. Had they not rolled back Dodd-Frank, I don't think we'd be talking about this. In 2008, after the last banking crisis, it was Elizabeth Warren who said, we're not doing this right, and there's going to be another problem, and here we have one. And so, John, I'll start with you. The bailout this week and the potential bailout, I don't think we've – not only do I not think we've covered this adequately in the press, I don't think we have a handle on what the problem is. Your thoughts?
Probably not. This is one of those issues that, you know, you lose expertise in newsrooms through layoffs and what have you. And there's not a lot of really good financial journalists out there.
With the exception of our friend from CNBC,
Eamon Jabbers, of course. Yeah. He's their chief, I believe, Washington correspondent now. Eamon does great work, but there's not like, you know, when, for instance, I wrote about this in my newsletter, CQ Afternoon Briefing this week, and I don't have that depth. So I'm speaking of myself right now, but you have to cover it. You have to ask when I'm on the Hill, I have to ask lawmakers, you know, what they might be able to do or if they feel a need right now. And as of late last week, they didn't, the senators I talked to didn't feel the need to act legislatively. So there's just not a lot of depth here. You know, this isn't, I think we've all become Ukraine experts healthcare experts over the years, but this one pops up once a decade. It's one of those issues, it seems like, and we just don't have a lot of depth in it. Now, if you're making newsroom decisions, because it doesn't come up all the time, you're not going to put resources, and by resources, you know what I mean. I mean, people. You're not going to, yeah, people are your most expensive expenditure, and you're not going to put a lot of people in it. So there are a lot of reasons, and if you could probably, I know a guy who could probably draw a line back to Ronald Reagan with media consolidation, that this is another product of that, because we're, you know, corporate ownership, probably not going to put a lot into financial reporting when I could get clicks other ways.
Well, I'll say this, and then Michael, I'll let you jump in. But here's my take on it from having covered this these issues for a while. When the multinational banks and the largest banks were threatened with failure, they were too big to fail, and we bailed them out. This is a regional bank that failed, and the multis are bailing them out. To me, it just looks like they're a forced merger, that we are losing smaller and regional banks the same as we have lost smaller and regional reporting, smaller regional businesses. So to me, it looks again like, yes, it is the consolidation of the banking industry. And, you know, I remember years ago, I had a regional bank, Chevy Chase. It got bought out. I was with them for 20 some odd years, and it became part of Citibank, and I could not stand the service. The service went away. They were not. So I chose a regional bank to go to, just because I liked dealing with human beings better than calling up on the phone and getting it out, you know, my request outsourced to a phone bank in India. But that's just me. Michael, I'll let you jump in.
So as you know, whenever you ask me a question, I say, well, let's go back in time, yes, before we answer the question, so that we understand.
We're going back to 2008.
We're going way back, way further back than that. It used to be that there was a law on the books called the Glass-Steagall.
Yes, let's go back to Glass-Steagall.
So the Glass-Steagall Act did not allow banks to also be investment companies and insurance companies. You couldn't consolidate. There was non-porous walls among those various types of institutions, and that was passed in 1933. In response to what was believed to be predatory behavior on the part of financial institutions. So that's the law. The banks have been had been complaining about it from the day it was passed, and they get to 1999, and what is proposed by Senator Phil Graham of Texas, I think chairman of the Senate Banking Committee and a recipient of banking funds, and Jim Leach, a moderate from Iowa, and Tom Bliley, a Republican. The Graham Leach Bliley Act of 1999 repeals Glass-Steagall, and it allows for the types of consolidation that Glass-Steagall prohibited. At the time of the debate, John Dingell, a Democrat from Michigan, argued against it, saying what this would do, his words, would create banks that are too big to fail and would necessarily result in a bailout by the federal government. It passed, and Clinton signed it into law. And ever since, in my view, ever since the passage of the Graham Leach Bliley Act, we encounter every period of time what Dingell predicted, which was too big to fail banks and federal bailouts. And so the question is it time to revisit the prohibitions that Glass-Steagall provided for?
Yes.
Now, it's not the way the modern economy works. We're not a savings and loan sort of banking-based community. So maybe it's not Glass-Steagall that comes back, but maybe the consolidations that Graham Leach Bliley allowed for have to be rolled back so that we have banks that are accountable in ways that under the current law, they are not.
Well, yeah. And Glass-Steagall also helped form the FDIC, which insured the deposits to a certain amount. And now banks being so large, they're much larger than the insured amount that the government will guarantee that they'll refund. So that becomes part of the problem, I believe, and why you need to revisit the act to break up the banking industry. But that's just—
Well, but I mean, I think the conversation to that exact point is the cap too low?
Way too low.
Because, you know, yes, it's a lot of money. I think what it is, like $250,000.
$250,000
is the cap. But, you know, if you have a large, 401k or other things that are in banking institutions over the course of your lifetime, and you get to be retirement age, you may well have that amount of money or more.
Or if you're a business and you've invested and put your money in a bank, you're going to have more than that.
And so I think fundamentally Graham Leach Bliley needs to be rethought. But I think until and unless that's done, they really have to think about raising the insured limit for depositors, not for bank owners or
private depositors.
Yeah, private sector depositors.
Yeah.
And I think Biden has it right in this case, which saying that the federal government will insure the deposits of individual depositors, but is not about to give safe haven to the bank board and the bank executives, and he'll claw back if he can any bonuses that they got or prevent additional bonuses.
Yeah, I love how they all got bonuses right before they went under. Gotta love that.
It's just a coincidence.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with reality.
We do we do these things when we do these things.
Yeah, John, I'll give you a last word on it.
Yeah, on the cap, interesting that Michael brings up raising the cap. Elizabeth Warren, very progressive, very big bank critic, financial sector critic, over the years, a Democrat from Massachusetts, a word I can't say. And she was on the Sunday show, one of the Sunday shows this morning, and she is calling for raising the cap. She didn't get into, specific limits. The White House not ruling that out yet. And for the first time this morning, Patrick McHenry, who is one of the more serious House Republicans, he's chairman of the Financial Services Committee. He's one to watch. He's a potential future speaker down the road. He's respected across that caucus. He's talking to the White House.
He's respected on both sides of the aisle.
Yes, absolutely. He's talking to everybody. He's involved here. He didn't rule out raising the caps this morning. So this is starting, it feels like, to gain some momentum. And again, they're not doing very much else legislatively right now. So if this catches fire and Biden gets on board and everybody's comfortable with it, we could start to see hearings and And, you know, maybe they pass something on this year. They certainly have the floor time.
Well, wait a second, though. You've got to, before you can deal with a financial crisis, you've got to deal with Bo Biden's wife's benefiting from illegal finances and Hunter Biden and maybe his next door neighbor. I mean, that has to take priority over this, don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I think this is an occasion when a lawmaker might tell you we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Which lawmaker? And do they have a video?
Yeah, right. I'll close it with this before we move on to the serious problems of March Madness. And that is, and letters, the Glass-Steagall Act came about because of the Depression. And mm-hmm. It was to ensure that we would not have a resurgence or a reappearance or you know, a rerun of that particular horrible part of our you know, that economic collapse. Removing the Glass-Steagall and in the last few years has weakened our system and opened us up to the type of economic woes that we've seen over the last 20 years. So I will just say that Glass-Steagall should be revisited. And these large banks need to be broken up or we're just going to be screwed. We're part of a technological feudalism unless that it's made more democratic. That's my final thought. Now, quickly from letters, I do have from a guy, John Lyon from Arkansas, who wants to know from Michael, Michael, do you think that Donald Trump will ever, and we've covered this many times, I'll give you, you know, 30 seconds to, you know, to go over it because I guess they don't get it. But do you, and sorry, John, I'm not lying. I'm not coming after you personally. But do you think that Donald Trump will ever see the inside of a prison cell?
Not unless there is a case that can be made on the January 6th side of the ledger. I think the other cases, as serious as they are, will not result in incarceration if Trump were convicted of those crimes.
There you go. And John, for you, this one comes from a guy named Steve Shetler, who wants to know, I got names this week instead of anonymous, instead of, you know, weird monikers. So I'm very happy for that instead of weird handles. But this guy wants to know if you think there's any hope that Congress can work in a bipartisan manner in the next 2 years for the benefit of the U.S. instead of the benefit of either party.
Oh, how to answer that one? It's the same answer that I've given before here and elsewhere. You know, there are five things that I'm watching for them to do this year, and then one probably next year. I'm not ready to add some kind of financial reform to that yet, but check back next week. You know, I think spending bills in September probably punt them a little longer than that. So avoiding a government shutdown, addressing the debt ceiling, that could be as easy as suspending it for a little while. A farm bill, that's the one that I think takes the whole Congress to do. So they're working on it now. That's going to take forever. Now that benefits both parties. That's one where everyone has an incentive to come to the table and do it seriously. That touches so much of the economy. So farm bills, spending bills, avoiding government shutdowns, defense policy bill, they do that every year. And, you know, I don't, they may be able to get together on some kind of another China bill, technology bill, semiconductors, that kind of thing. But other than that, I wouldn't look for this to be a bipartisan Congress at all. The incentives just aren't there. Republicans, the Senate map is so red already that it looks like, you know, they're already thinking to their majority. So the incentives just aren't there. But if they do those five things and maybe you add on something like a financial reform bill, then, like I said last week, I think you have to give this Congress a B, even with these House investigations which haven't produced a lot of evidence. They haven't connected any dots. They just throw dots on the whiteboard and don't connect anything. But other than that, you know, if the debt ceiling, if we don't default, if the government doesn't shut down, if they do a meaningful farm bill, and it usually is, and a couple other things, you know, that would be more than a lot of the forecasters predicted back in January.
And for me, it's from Packers fan 59 who wants to know, I am not an Aaron Rodgers fan. I am a Green Bay Packer fan, a Bart Starr fan. He can go anywhere he wants. I'll be happy to see him leave Green Bay. The serious part of your question asked of me is why do reporters always, they want a two-part question. And the second part was, why do reporters always seem to go against those in power? And I will tell you this, that's our job, to ask questions. It's their job to put their best foot forward. It's our job to hold them accountable for what they do, whether they are Republican, Democrat, middle of the road, far right, far left, I don't care. I am not a fan of any politician. I agree with H.L. Mencken. The only way to look at a politician is down. And with that said, final thoughts. Michael's got his hand up. Go ahead, Michael.
Just, I wanted to amend my answer on the question of whether Trump would ever see the inside of a jail. What I tried to say, but didn't say it clearly, is that the only conviction that would be worthy of jail time is a January 6th conviction. However, I would expect Democrat or Republican president at the time of that conviction and sentencing, potential sentencing, would have to think very seriously about pardoning.
Or commuting the sentence.
Or commuting a la what Ford did with to Nixon.
To end that long national nightmare.
It may be in the best interest of the country for whatever president it is, Republican or Democrat, to do just that.
Yeah, and I don't think he'll ever see the inside of a cell. I think the actuary tables or a bad hamburger will get him before then. But we'll close with everybody's March Madness has been, all of those have been busted. Everybody's lost out there. So including Barack Obama's brackets, they're all busted. So I'll start with Michael. Who do you like that's left?
Well, I can tell you that my bracket still has, I think, I have to check it, but I'm pretty sure my bracket still has an Alabama-Houston final.
Wow.
And I think they're still both in it. I could be mistaken. I might have Purdue there, who obviously are not going to make it. I have Houston winning the national championship, but I think that's the easy, that was the easy money bet at the outset.
John, how about you?
I got out of the bracket business a few years ago. I got tired of being frustrated by Thursday evening and wasting, you know, $10 or whatever the buy-in would be. And now I just sit back and I just watch the hoops, man. And I just, you have it on maybe two screens or just flipping back between games. And I don't have to worry about who do I have in this game or my champion's down by six and who cares?
Right.
I just want to see buzzer beaters and defensive stops and see the crowd go crazy. It's a great spectacle. I will say this, as we're recording, Xavier just eliminated Pittsburgh. So the ACC, the conference of my youth, the Atlantic Coast Conference, has one team left. This great former basketball conference only has the Miami Hurricanes, who have an outside shot to win. Yeah, Duke's out.
Yeah, Carolina, and
UNC didn't even make the tournament. So this once great basketball power conference is a shell of its former self. Yeah. And all of this, we've seen Kansas is out, Purdue's out, Duke's out, all these upsets. This is the difference.
Is Kentucky still in it? I think they are, right?
I'm not sure, but this is what we're seeing. This is the transfer portal. This has changed college basketball. What it does in college football, in FBS, Division I college football, it makes the strongest stronger. It makes Georgia stronger. It makes, you know, those.
But in basketball, makes them weaker.
But it makes them weaker. Kids want to play, and there are more kids who can play basketball, and they're willing to go play at Wichita State or Xavier or school, you know,
Valparaiso or
yeah, they'll play 35 minutes a game, whereas if they stay at Alabama, they might play five.
Yeah,
and those kids, as they say, those kids can hoop. Yeah, and that's what we're seeing.
I'm an ABD man and always have been, anybody but Duke. So when they lose, I cheer. And so I'm very happy that they're gone. Kentucky is where I grew up. Missouri is where I went to school. And Louisville is the city I grew up in. So I've always been a Louisville fan. They never went anywhere this year. I think Kentucky's still in it. I kind of cheering for them to lose. And my alma mater, Mizzou, lost. So I don't really care.
Oh, no, but Brian, you have to root for Princeton.
Yeah.
Right? The number 15 seed.
Yes.
Going to the Sweet 16. You gotta root with your heart here.
Yeah, Kentucky, well, I always root for the underdog. After my guys are out, I was rooting for Louisville to make it with just four wins this year, and somehow they didn't win their tournament. So that as long as Duke is down, I'm happy. So
well, Fairleigh Dickinson could be
that's
be
a it. I'm a Fairleigh right? Dickinson fan now. Yeah. So with that said, thanks everybody. Once again, this is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Thanks for joining us, and we'll hopefully catch you next time. Thanks a lot.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.